Fathers, I never wish to speak to you about the overseas mission of hearing confessions, because deep within me I believe firmly and unwaveringly that all my works are worthless. This conviction lies very deep within my soul. I believe that, as a man, I am nothing, and I regard the dissolution of this nothingness as something good. But a few days ago, as I was speaking and discussing this with one of the fathers of our monastery, people are quite fond of us. As our conversation unfolded, we came to speak about our work abroad, and he said to me, "Geronta, tell us about the grace of God at work abroad and about how much good it is doing. This will be for our own edification as well, and it will preserve what you have to say because we are only human, and one day we will depart from this life." He said that something good might come of it and benefit people in the future. As I have told you from the beginning, I did not want to do this, but at the Father's urging, I shall begin to say a few things so that they may be preserved. As you saw, this year I was thinking of not going abroad to hear confessions for many different reasons connected with my responsibilities. I told the people that I was wavering between yes and no, and that I would make it a matter of prayer, whatever God might say in the way he knows how to make his will known. I too will follow in obedience. I prayed a great deal, and I asked others to pray as well, that God might grant illumination concerning what he himself wished to be done. I stripped myself of all self-will. Even if something seemed reasonable to me, and I thought it ought to be done, above all else, the doing of God's will had to prevail. Through prayer and with the passing of time, I waited to see when God would give assurance and what he would say. Of course, my personal assurance was that the pain had increased greatly. And then there was the pain in my soul for those souls whom I know. How great their need is, this pain in my soul was very great. Then the telephone calls and letters from abroad revealed their pain and their need. And also the cry of those souls, pleading with us not to abandon them. I shall mention just two or three specific examples from among the many, to show, or rather, to make known, how God spoke and how he always speaks. He has many ways. In one letter, a man abroad who has received great illumination writes, "Father, in Greece every place has a church or a holy shrine. The paths, the roads, the villages, and the cities are filled with the presence of holy people who once passed along those paths and roads. Holy people pass through the mountains and villages, leaving behind their traces and spiritual benefit for souls and sanctifying those places. Our homeland is filled with all these things, but here abroad, no such person has ever passed through, among us who are strangers, emigrants living far from home. For so many years no one has passed through who might leave spiritual benefit in his footsteps. We beg you, do not abandon us. Your passing through here, through cities, villages, stations, and the places where people gather, has meant so much. In the end, it has brought so much spiritual benefit, and we all speak of this good work that God has accomplished. And I think that, in bringing you here to us, God is showing that he has not abandoned us. We too are his children, under his wise providence, which cares for our salvation. That is why. You took the trouble to help us and made a beginning. Do not leave the work unfinished. We wait for you anxiously, hoping that you will help us." Another dear soul had been completely estranged from God, but my visit to that village changed the people there. When this soul heard that perhaps Father would not come, she wrote to me, "Geronta, as soon as I learned this sorrowful news, I shut myself in my room, closed the doors and windows, fell to my knees, and wept bitterly, shedding many tears. And in my prayer I said, 'My God, do not deprive us of this man who brought us into this light, so that we might see you. Be washed clean of our grave sins, and cast off our wickedness and defilement. Please bring this man back to us. It is in your hands to deprive us of him, but this year you must surely bring him to us.' And my tears, Father, soaked the ground beneath me, and I believe that God will hear our loud cries here abroad." And so many other things followed during this time of seeking to discern what God wills in this matter, far too many to recount. I would like to mention a few things from these 5 years of this ministry, both for our edification, as our Father said, and also so that they may be preserved and perhaps someday benefit others. In my second year in Montreal, I had spent the whole day, until nightfall, hearing the confessions of our Christians there. We gathered in a fairly large house to speak a little about the things of God. When I arrived, the people were waiting, and someone there said, "Father, today please speak to us from your experience about the existence of demons. Speak to us about this subject so that those of us who know nothing at all about it may learn." And indeed, drawing on what I had learned from my blessed elder and from the fathers, as well as from my own experience, I spoke about various matters concerning the influence of demons, how people are brought down by demonic power, the demons' existence and nature, their cunning, and so forth. The talk continued until midnight. Then one of the brethren said, "Geronta, you should stop, because you have confessions again in the morning and need to rest." "May it be blessed," I replied. And the people began to leave. A few minutes later, there was a commotion and a noise out in the corridor. I saw the women coming into the room where I was, terrified and in tears, each one clutching at my cassock. "Father, a woman outside has become demonically possessed. She is shouting and screaming. Her eyes were rolling back, and there were many other such signs, all of them demonic." The demon itself was shouting, "This man has exposed me. He has brought me out into the open. What is he doing here in Canada? Why has he come? He has come to take away those who belong to me. I had them securely bound. What am I going to do to him? I will take revenge on him." And it said many other things that cannot be repeated. I said, "Be calm. Do not make any noise, and the woman will settle down." And indeed, she did. She was a grown young woman, the one who had become possessed, and I had her taken into a room. I then went in as well. Her eyes were closed. She was trembling like a fish, and she opened her mouth and spoke everything that lay hidden in her subconscious. She revealed things she had never told anyone. Doing what my duty required, I opened the eucologion, put on my epitrachelion, and read over her the prayers of St. Basil the Great. When the prayers were finished, she opened her eyes and became calm. She was no longer trembling, and she said to me, "Father, I want to confess to you." I said, "My child, come to the church tomorrow morning, and I will hear your confession." And so it happened. After she had confessed, and I had seen the cause of her demonic possession, she said to me, "Father, I do not have only one demon within me. I have many. And now they are cursing and blaspheming you." I said, "It does not matter. Those words are not yours. They belong to the devil. That is his language. That is how he speaks." She went out into the main church, since I was hearing confessions in the chapel. As she sat outside, she began shouting, "Do not go in to confess to him. Come to me, and I will hear your confessions. Do not go into him." And she said many other things. This young woman had a demon, but it had not manifested itself for years. She received Holy Communion and attended divine liturgies and the paraclesis services there abroad, but from the moment of that talk, the demon revealed and manifested itself, and it became clear exactly what this young woman had within her. Then another woman came to confess. She knelt before me and said with tears, "Father, I did not believe in the existence of demons yesterday when you spoke to us about their existence, their works, their deceptions, and so many other things. I believed them because you were the one telling us. But now I have seen it in reality, and I know that what you said was indeed a very great truth. I believe and confess that a demon truly exists, waging war against us and bringing us down into sin. This incident brought great spiritual benefit. God permitted it for the benefit of souls." The news spread far and wide, and people telephoned me from America and said, "Father, come to us as well. Come and hear our confessions. We are filthy through and through. Please come. If you cannot come to us, then we will come to you." I thought about how so many people could possibly come to me, so I went to their state instead, and the grace of God accomplished a very great work there, reaching deep into people's souls. I was going deeper. Last year, I was hearing confessions in a church in Toronto. The church caretaker came up to me and said, "Father, do you recognize me?" I said, "No, my child. How would I know you?" "I am the woman over whom you read the exorcisms when I was possessed by a demon. Do you remember the place you visited? I was in that violent state, and you read the exorcisms over me." Then I did remember her. "Yes, it is me. Father, I have been healed, and I do not know how to thank you." You are thanking me? You expect this from me? I do not heal people. I have not even healed myself. How could I make you well? It was the grace of God, through the prayers of St. Basil the Great, that worked the miracle. Give thanks to God and to St. Basil the Great. I was hearing confessions in the church again when a young woman came to me. Read the prayers over me, Father, because I have a demon. And indeed she did. I read the exorcisms over her. I encounter such things almost every day. And one day, as I was reading the prayers over her, the demon seized her right there before me, and even I do not know exactly what happened. Of course, I pray that God healed her. On another occasion, when I arrived at the church, the people were waiting outside. The church had not yet been opened, so that they could go in and wait. As I entered, a terrified man came close beside me and began shouting, "Father, there is the devil! He is chasing me, Father. He keeps circling around me. There he is, Father, behind the pillar, behind that woman. Please save me," I said. "Don't be afraid, my good man. He cannot harm you." I made the sign of the cross over his head. "Come inside." He clung to my cassock and would not let go. "Father, he will seize me." "He will not seize you, my child. Do not be afraid." I took the man into the chapel and read the prayers over him. I said, "Do not be afraid. Nothing will happen to you." And indeed, the man calmed down and left. In Chicago, the Christians had somehow been informed that I would be going to hear confessions in a very large church and parish. I arrived early in the morning, and the people were already waiting. At midday, I stopped for a little rest. As I came out of the church, a Christian told me, "Father, after you began hearing confessions, two evangelical women came outside the church. They were shouting and telling the Christians who had come for confession, 'You must not confess. Look at the Holy Gospel. You must not confess to a man, but only to God.' They caused quite a disturbance. The people naturally told them that they had to leave, but they persisted. Then the priest came and said, 'Ladies, go home or go to your own church and preach there. This is an Orthodox church, and these are Orthodox Christians. You are not permitted to spread this distortion here.' 'No, Father, you are mistaken.' They remained there, insisting and shouting. Then the priest was forced to call 100, the police emergency number, and the police came and removed them. This brother asked me, 'Father, if they come again, what should we do?' I said, 'If they come, let them come to me one at a time. Let me see each one, and let us speak together. Let her be involved.' I resumed hearing confessions, and after a little while, one of the two women came and began doing the same thing again. The young man asked her, 'Would you like to see the Father?' She replied, 'Yes, I would, so that he can enlighten me.' She entered the confessional, and the moment our eyes met, the moment she looked at me and I looked at her, to see who this remarkable woman was, she immediately fell to her knees. She began to weep and repent, asking forgiveness, and then asked to make her confession. Of course, I heard her general confession, and she asked my forgiveness for her error. She said, 'Father, I was led astray, and now I am returning to the Orthodox Church.' In Vancouver, the Orthodox sister of another man from the same heretical group brought him to me with great difficulty, hoping that I might help him abandon the error of that heresy. Of course, he argued back, and said the usual things with the illumination. 'God granted me,' I told him, 'whatever I could.' Then he began to change his approach. He too fell to his knees, asked forgiveness, and confessed. Since it was Sunday, and the Divine Liturgy was being celebrated, I said to him, 'My good man, get up now, and go to the priest in the church, so that he may chrismate you. In this way, you will become an Orthodox Christian again.' And by the grace of God, he is now in our Orthodox faith." This woman also has a sister who is a Chileast. I told her to bring that sister to me, but she would not agree under any circumstances. There was also another soul, an elderly woman in Toronto, who was likewise an evangelical. By the grace of God, she too returned to Orthodoxy. The grace of God works very many miracles. It brings people back from the path of error to the path of truth, the path of metanoia, repentance, and atonement. We see this in the way people's lives are changed. The devil is losing ground, and that is why he roars and becomes dangerously enraged. Last year, when I was in the city of Lancaster, I went there for the first time at the request of the priest and the people, and God brought a great many souls that night. While I was asleep, I saw the devil twice. He came within a yard of me and showed me his immeasurable malice. He was so savage and so terrifying. In his features he seemed to have gathered all the malice, hostility, and hatred of every demon. He was tearing me to pieces with his eyes. He was saying to me, "I will take revenge on you for what you are doing." I immediately came to myself and began to pray, imploring my most holy Theotokos, our most holy Theotokos, to shelter me from the devil's malice. The devil. It was at one of the gatherings we held with the people downstairs beneath the church. We often did this after the evening confession session. The priest interpreted into English. We spoke there for quite some time. Then the priest said, "Let us finish now and come back here again tomorrow." Among the people, I noticed a restless man who gave the impression that he wanted to say or ask something and was deeply troubled. I said, "Father, let us hear what this man wants." "Go ahead, my good man." The man stood up deeply distressed and anxious and said to me, "Father, what you said about Christ, about the Apostle Paul, and about the other man was all very well, but who will deliver me from this anguish, from the torment of unbelief? Who will tell me, who will assure me and convince me that God exists? Many people like me will suffer. Who will help them? Who will deliver me, at last, from this difficulty and this struggle?" I said, "Let us pause for a moment, my dear Christians, and say a few words to this man." And I spoke to him about God. I spoke to him about the existence of God. I gave him a very powerful and illuminating argument that Napoleon the Great had once presented to one of his generals, leading that general to believe in God. When the Christians heard the story about Napoleon, they found it so beautiful and compelling that they immediately applauded this truly powerful demonstration of God's existence. I said to the man, "Come to the church tomorrow morning to confess. I will tell you more and give you a helpful book." He came, made a general confession, and I spoke to him further about God. Then I said, "I do not have the book with me now, but I will send it to you." And I did exactly as I had promised. A devout young woman had brought this man. In her own way, she had moved him and brought him there. I told her, "Help him, but be careful yourself, because the devil has many ways of ensnaring people." And so I kept following the situation, both the man's and the woman's. Then, about 2 months ago, this woman telephoned me and said, "Father, I have been trying for days to reach you by telephone, so I could tell you about Kostas. Do you remember him?" "Of course I do, and I want to know what happened next." "Well, Father, this man died, and listen to what happened. After he had confessed to you and all that, sometime later he went down to Greece. He became ill, but the doctors there could do nothing for him, so he came back here." By chance, I thought I would telephone and ask, "Has Kostas returned from Greece?" And indeed he had returned. So I asked him, "Kostas, how is your health?" He said to me, "I am ill, Mrs. Lella." I said, "Please, come here so I can see you." And he came to the house. "Listen, we will go to church so that you can confess again and receive Holy Communion." "Yes, let's go." And indeed I notified the priest, and we went. He confessed the few things that remained and received Holy Communion. Then she said to him, "Kostas, we are going to the hospital. Let us go." At the hospital, the examinations showed that his body was filled internally with cancerous growths. It was an extremely serious case. They took him into surgery and operated on him. After the doctors had done everything they could, they took him to a hospital room. During those days, he kept telling me, "Telephone Father Ephraim. Telephone him and tell him that I want to go and live near him. I want to go to him and become a monk." "All right, Kostas, be at peace. I will telephone Father. But Father, for 15 days I could not reach you." In the end, I had to tell him, "Kostas, I reached Father." "What did he say?" "He said that you should get well, and then he will call you." All right, after that, Kostas took a turn for the worse. "I'll bring the priest so you can receive Holy Communion." "Yes, bring him to me." So I brought the priest, Father Angelos. When I brought him, Kostas was in a stupor. I brought the priest, "Please, open your mouth and receive Christ." He is watching over you. Then I fell to my knees, and my husband and I began to beg God to work his miracle so that he would open his mouth and receive Holy Communion. And I wept, Father, and cried aloud, my God, hear my prayer. Help this man receive Holy Communion before he departs. Suddenly, he opened his eyes and his mouth, and the priest gave him Holy Communion. Immediately afterward, he closed his eyes and mouth again and fell back into the stupor. We were filled with joy, gladness, and relief because he had received Christ within himself and would depart with this great provision for the journey. Once again, we began crying aloud, glorifying God, and thanking him with tears. Then suddenly, this man, who was about to die, opened his eyes, sat upright in the bed, and Kostas himself began glorifying God. Glory to you, O God, he praised and hymned him at length, with such longing and love for God. You should have heard the way he spoke those words. After he had said all these things and glorified God, he lay back down, closed his eyes, drew three breaths, and fell asleep in the Lord. This man had been lost and unbelieving, but the grace of God found this woman and gave her love for her neighbor. Through the cooperation of the church, this man's salvation was accomplished. After holy confession, he died of cancer. These are great miracles. None of these people had ever been to confession. Indeed, from what I witnessed and practiced throughout all those years, I can say with conviction that 99.9% of these people had never confessed. Every time we go there, the number of people doubles. New people come, and generally none of them have ever confessed. One woman said to me, Father, can you come to the hospital to see two people who have been gravely injured in a traffic accident? Of course I will come. This is my desire, to see those people who are about to depart this life. We were going to leave. As soon as I arrived, I went in. There were two men in a hospital room, separated from each other by a curtain. The moment one of them saw me, he turned his head away, showing that he did not want anything. The other was more severely injured. There was not a single part of his body that had not been hurt. Only his eyes were open, and his mind was perfectly sound. I gestured to him and asked, Do you want to confess? I spoke to him, and he answered yes with his eyes. Yes, I do. Since you cannot speak, I will ask you about your sins. If you have committed what I ask you about, close your eyes. If you have not, keep them open. And so, by opening and closing his eyes, we had a very profound experience of confession. He made a good and complete confession. Naturally, such a confession begins with childhood and continues up to the present moment, proceeding in order through the sins a person may have committed at every age. His soul found rest, and his face lit up. His eyes shone with joy and contentment. Then he gestured to me, asking, Where are you from? I said, I am from the Holy Mountain. As a Christian and a Greek, he had heard about it long ago. And once again, he showed how deeply grateful he was to have confessed to a man from the Holy Mountain. Then I told him, You are all right now. You will receive the Holy Mysteries. I also told the nurse, who was Greek, See to it, my child, that the sick man receives Holy Communion because he may not live. And here we see the providence of God arranging even his injury, so that he would find himself in a position to ask for confession. Had he been healthy, perhaps this opportunity would not have arisen for him. All the cancer patients departed with their souls cleansed, with great joy and spiritual consolation. When a person confesses and then departs this life, sin can no longer lay claim to him. Through death, sin no longer has the right to prevail over a person. There was also an elderly man who was paralyzed, gravely ill, and had never confessed at all in his entire life. His son said, Father, can you come? That is what I am here for. He does not want to confess, he said. We will go, I said, and may God bless whatever comes of it. So we went there. Father, I have brought the priest, your confessor. Won't you make your confession, Father? You are old now. No, my child, he said. I have done nothing. I am innocent, my child. I am a good man. I said to him, All right, Grandpa, may I read a prayer over you? Would you like that? Just a little prayer? A little prayer, Father. Please read it. His son quietly slipped away and left the two of us alone. I sat down beside him. I sat beside him and gently stroked the dear old man. My dear grandfather, perhaps when you were a child, something happened now and then, this or that. By keeping the conversation light, asking him about his age and little stories from his past, one thing after another, by the grace of God and without his even realizing it, I led him through a full and sincere holy confession. His soul understood what had happened, and he was filled with such joy. Then he began calling out, "My child, come in. My child, come. What is it, Father?" I confessed, "My child, and a burden has been lifted from me. Thank you, my child. Thank you, my child." Only a few days later, the elderly man died. In one city, a woman came to me and said, "Father, my child is unconscious after a car accident. There were three young men, and they were driving very fast. One was killed instantly, one was completely unharmed, and my own child lies writhing on the bed entirely unresponsive, neither living nor dying. Only his breathing could be heard. He was suffering and trembling all over. Poor as I am, I went up to him, put on my stole, and began reading prayers over him. At the end, I took out a small prayer rope. The nurse received it with great reverence and placed it above his head. After that, I went back two or three times. The doctor said the boy may die any day now. His parents were in great anguish. In any case, I said, we will do our duty, the duty of our church. Through her prayers, whatever is to happen will happen. And with God's help, that young man lived. God also counted him worthy to come to confession afterward. There are Greek Christians in the hospitals. We go and visit them, trying to bring them close to God. There was one poor Greek woman who had lived there for years in a Catholic nursing home. Because an Orthodox priest did not visit her, this poor woman received communion from a Catholic priest. The priest would come with communion and ask, "Do you want to receive?" And she would receive it. When I eventually learned what was happening, I went to see her. I heard the elderly woman's confession. She had never confessed before. She said, "Father, a Catholic priest comes here, and I receive Christ in communion. I must receive Christ within me." I told her, "My child, the communion of the Catholics is not Christ, because there is no descent of the Holy Spirit upon that communion. It is not the body and blood of Christ. That communion is devoid of grace, entirely devoid of grace. For God's sake, do not receive communion there again." "Bless me, Father, I will not receive there again. And when the priest comes, what shall I tell him?" "Tell him, Father, I will receive communion from an Orthodox priest." I also told the Orthodox priest to bring her Holy Communion, and he did indeed give her communion. After that, she never again received communion from the Catholic priest. This dear saintly woman was in one of the many cities I visited, among the many cancer patients. A lady said to me, "There is a professor here who has cancer and is going to die. She is a very close friend of mine and a good person, and she was among the first Greeks to come here. Of course, let us go." We went to see her, and she was a very good soul. Of course, she had not confessed the things she needed to confess. She made her confession with tears, and I said to her, "My child, your passport is ready, and it is time for you to pass over to heaven. Father, will I be allowed to enter?" "Of course, by the grace of Christ, because the key that opens the door of paradise is what we have just done." This confession is the key that has opened for you the door of the kingdom, and you will certainly enter the kingdom of God. And the tears were streaming from her eyes. Afterward, I left and went to another city. When I had finished hearing confessions there, I returned to the previous city, longing to visit that dear soul and see how she was doing and whether she needed anything further. When I told the woman, "Let us go and visit the cancer patient," she said to me, "Geronta, after her confession, she lived only 3 more days, and then she departed for the other world." One Sunday I was hearing confessions, and when I had finished, they said to me, "Father, could you come and visit 2 people with cancer?" They took me by car, and we went to the home of a man who had an oxygen cylinder above his head. He was a man who, in short, had never set foot inside a church and had never received Holy Communion in his life. I saw him in the anguish and pain of cancer, and I said to him, "Man of God, would you like to make your confession?" "Yes, Father, I would like to confess." As was my custom, I heard his general confession, and his poor soul found rest. I instructed the person caring for him to arrange for him to receive Holy Communion, to have Holy Unction administered to him, and to continue receiving the Holy Gifts. From there we went to visit a woman who also had cancer. She too made her confession, and a few days later both of them died,